From KUAR News in Little Rock, this is a look at Arkansas news, politics, and more. Coming up.
Election Day in Arkansas. A look at the presidential primary and what it could mean for other issues in the state.
Two Arkansas Supreme Court races are decided after $1.6 million in advertising. That prompts the governor to float the idea of an appointment system.
With changes to Arkansas's Medicaid expansion to be considered by lawmakers in a few weeks, Governor Hutchinson says Tuesday was good for the chances of its continuation.
And a fundraiser at the Arkansas Governor's Mansion benefits the ongoing restoration of Johnny Cash's boyhood home. I'll talk with his daughter, Roseanne Cash. I'm Michael Hipplin.
I'm Chris Hickey.
For the week ending Friday, March 4th, this is KUAR's Week in Review podcast. Well, Jacob Kaufman and Sarah Weitz-Kotacek were not able to join us for this week's podcast. So, Chris, it's just you and I this week.
Hey there.
How's it going?
Pretty well.
Busy week, though, and one in which Arkansas got quite a bit of attention for the first time being part of Super Tuesday and leading up to the presidential election. We've had a string of presidential candidates come through Arkansas, and that really spurred a lot of excitement. We actually had a record number of people who came out to the polls, and I know you've been looking at some of the data.
Yeah, well, in past years, you know, Arkansas has had a primary in May, but this year it was moved up to March 1st, and as you said, the number of presidential candidates come through the state. I think the weekend before Super Tuesday, we had something like four candidates just in that weekend. But yeah, turnout was much higher than in the past few primary years. In 2012, 2014, 2008, this year we had 639,000 people, registered voters, turn out. It's almost twice as many as were in 2012 and 2014. In 2008, where there was a contested presidential primary on both sides, there were only 544,000 Arkansans to turn out. So that's one of the big stories. The other big story is turnout among Republican voters was especially high. More than 409,000 Republican voters participated in this year's primary. That's up from a number in 2012 when there was only 152,000 Republican primary voters, and it was up from 2008 as well. Democratic voters, there are more of them this time around than there were in the 2012 primary and the 2014 primary, although in the last contested presidential primary on the Democratic side in 2008, as we know, when Barack Obama got the nomination, there were somewhere around 314,000, but this year only 220,000 Arkansans cast a Democratic ballot. So you can definitely see there that there are more Republicans turning out for this election than there are Democrats. I don't know if that's something for the Democratic Party of Arkansas to be worried about. Certainly, I think a lot of people who knew Hillary Clinton or had supported her in the state thought that her ties to the state here would bring out a lot more Democratic voters, but it's arguably not the case.
And why don't we hear some from the heads of the two state parties? Here first, Republican Party Chair Doyle Webb, who said that the results confirm for him that the shift in the Arkansas electorate to the Republican Party is indisputable.
For the first time in our history, we have voted 62% of those who decided to vote in a primary. It appears that 62% chose to vote in the Republican primary. That tells me that the realignment of Arkansas voters is continuing in a strong way. They may not be clear yet on who their candidate will be for the fall, but they're clear that they are Republican, or at least they're conservatives.
And Chris, you talked with the Democratic Party chair, Vincent Sulaco, who also found reasons to celebrate.
Democrats turned out in almost double the numbers that they did in 2012, which tells me that the Arkansas Democratic Party and Arkansas Democrats are alive and well and thriving. And as I have said repeatedly over the course of the last year, there are no permanent majorities anymore.
And interesting, Governor Hutchinson, as we had talked about on last week's podcast, really put a lot of support behind Senator Marco Rubio, and in particular had been critical of Donald Trump. What do you think this shows about the weight the governor had here on this race?
Well, Rubio finished third in the state on the Republican side. He garnered only about 25% of the vote. Well, meanwhile, Donald Trump, who, you know, as we heard last week, our governor really criticized heavily in an interview with NPR, Trump got 33% of the vote. And meanwhile, Ted Cruz also did pretty well. He got 30% of the vote. So it doesn't seem like the governor's words had a lot of sway with voters. And, nationally, a lot of commentators have noticed that, you know, Trump has been bringing out a lot of voters who haven't necessarily participated in past primary elections. And I think the kind of turnout that we saw in Arkansas's election may indicate that here as well.
Yeah, and exit polling showed that independents supported Donald Trump, as well as moderate conservatives.
Yeah, and really Trump, you know, among all his share of voters, he garnered kind of the same degree of participation from people who have different income levels, low income, high income, people of different education levels. He did pretty well with people who had high school educations or less. He got 37% of that vote, and people who have completed some college, 39% of the vote. This is based on a CBS exit poll. And I looked at a few other exit polls that kind of show the same kind of data. But, you know, he's really appealing to a wide swath of the Republican voter base. And another interesting point I'd like to touch on is in the CBS exit poll, they asked the voters which one of these four issues is the most important facing the country. And they listed immigration, economy, jobs, terrorism, and government spending. Out of all those Republican voters that were surveyed, 9% said immigration was their top issue. But of all the voters surveyed there who supported Trump, 53% said immigration was their top issue. So I don't know what that necessarily says about the Arkansas electorate, that we're really concerned with immigration, or Trump voters are really concerned with immigration. I just thought that was an interesting statistic.
Well, Governor Hutchinson did come out Tuesday night, as did Senator John Bozeman, and say that while they have issues with Trump, they would still support him if he became the eventual party nominee. But here's what Hutchinson told KUAR in terms of his concerns still about Trump and his hope that someone else can maybe step up somehow and end up as the Republican nominee.
I think he has too much entertainment value. It does not inspire me in terms of confidence. But when you look at the direction of our country overall, I think someone with a business background, somebody, even though I think is not the perfect candidate, he would be the nominee of our party. But it also means that he won in the marketplace of ideas.
And pretty much also said that anyone within the party Republican presidential nominees would be better than Hillary Clinton or Senator Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, that's what they say. But, Hillary Clinton did win the state with 66% of the vote among Arkansas Democrats. Bernie Sanders got 30%. As has been noted nationally among Super Tuesday states, Clinton did very well among African-American voters. She got about 90% of the African-American vote on the Democratic side, according to this CBS exit poll, kind of displaying her, I guess, rapport with voters in the South, especially African-American voters. And she did well with older voters as well.
And she came to Arkansas. Her one campaign appearance just before the election was in Pine Bluff, a predominantly African-American community, and whereas Senator Sanders did not set foot in Arkansas. But here's a little bit of what supporters of Hillary Clinton had to say after her very decisive win Tuesday night. KUAR's David Wallace was out at one election watch party and spoke with some longtime friends who have known Hillary since the 1970s.
Sheila Brofman's wedding reception was at the Arkansas Governor's Mansion, hosted by Hillary Clinton. It was during that time, more than 35 years ago, that an enduring, loyal friendship began, which made last night slightly emotional for Brofman.
It's like having a friend from high school, and you don't forget them. They're still your friend, they're still there, and you have a reunion, and that's what we're having, a great reunion for a wonderful friend. It's very exciting to have a friend run for president.
Former Little Rock Mayor Lottie Shackelford was a co-member with Hillary of a lunch group of politically involved women 30 years ago. Today, she couldn't be prouder.
We're on our road to having a woman for president and having had the experience of an African-American for president. I mean, you know, can't get any better than that in the political spectrum.
In Little Rock, I'm David Wallace.
So we'll see what happens now going forward. Obviously, the presidential race moves on to other states. Donald Trump has a lot of momentum. But still up in the air, there are a lot of strategies being considered by Republican Party establishment types to still try and keep Donald Trump from getting the nomination and ending up representing the party, which some feel would be devastating for the Republican brand.
Yeah, but they've got to feel pretty happy, especially in Arkansas, to see that level of turnout. I mean, just to return to it again, I looked up the figures for Pulaski County, and we usually think of Pulaski County as being a solidly Democratic place, but the numbers for Democratic and Republican voters were about even, about 46,000 Republicans, 46,000 Democrats turned out. And I looked up, you know, in 2008, there were 56,000 Democrats, whereas there were 28,000 Republicans who turned out. So, I mean, that tide of Republicanism does certainly seem to be spreading throughout the state and probably having an effect on a lot of other races down ballot.
Well, one of the other races that got a lot of attention, especially advertising dollars spent, was the two races for the Arkansas Supreme Court, in particular the race for Chief Justice. Chris, you did a lot of reporting on this, interviewing three of the four candidates, as well as submitting questions and getting a response from Courtney Goodson for the Chief Justice position. But first, talk a little bit about this, where we had so much money poured into the state by an outside group that doesn't disclose where its money comes from.
Yeah, I think the latest figure is there's $1.6 million in spending in the Arkansas Supreme Court races. There are two of them, one between Courtney Goodson and Dan Kemp, as you said, the other between Sean Womack, a circuit judge from Mountain Home, and Clark Mason, a Little Rock attorney. But what was notable about the spending in these races, especially for the Chief Justice position between Goodson and Kemp, is that this outside Washington, D.C. based group, so-called dark money group, because they don't have to disclose their donors, called the Judicial Crisis Network, spent over $600,000 in negative advertising against Goodson. And now there was no dark money group attacking Dan Kemp. But at the same time, Courtney Goodson did spend a lot of her own money. She did loan quite a bit to her own campaign. She spent about $330,000. Kemp spent about $107,000, but Kemp certainly benefited from the Judicial Crisis Network's attack ads on Goodson. He won by 57% with 7% of the vote.
And he said he wasn't aware of the or in any way involved in the ads. And Goodson said she accepted Kemp's comments. She believed that, and in a statement said that she would be able to work with him, looked forward to serving, because, of course, she's already an associate justice and will continue in that position, but now on the bench alongside Kemp.
Yeah, when these ads were running, as you said, he Kemp did put out some statements saying he firmly rejects the participation of the Judicial Crisis Network, particularly, and there was an attack ad on Goodson for her role in siding with in a unanimous decision against striking down the Arkansas voter ID law in 2014. That was a unanimous decision by the court, but for some reason this group really didn't like it. Now, I did talk to Kemp after he won. I was at his watch party down in downtown Little Rock. And, you know, I asked him just, you know, what he plans on doing when he takes up the role of Chief Justice. He'll be invested in that role starting the beginning of next year.
I'll try to do some of the things that I talked about during my campaign and work toward probably establishing some committees to work on that and report back to the Supreme Court and hopefully adopt some changes.
And those changes that he's talking about, he had proposed a broad set of ethics reforms to the judicial branch. He wanted to eliminate personal gifts as an option for judges. He wanted to strengthen the state public defender system, which isn't necessarily a role that the judiciary plays in overseeing the public defender system, but they do, you know, the Chief Justice can serve as a spokesperson and can advocate for increased funding in the legislature. He also wanted to see an expansion of drug courts. As you said, Goodson did release a statement saying she looked forward to working with him. And Kemp also said he did look forward to working alongside other members of the court. I asked him if, you know, the dynamic might be a little tarnished by this kind of, you know, this campaign, which had a lot of tension on both sides. And here's what he had to say about that.
It's going to take a little while for the dynamics of that group to get used to each other and to learn how to function effectively. So hopefully that'll be a short period of time and we'll be able to accomplish what we need to for the people of Arkansas.
So there you have it. I mean, we will not see these two Supreme Court justices take up the role until next year. I should note that Sean Womack, the former legislator and circuit judge, did beat Clark Mason by an overwhelming percentage also.
But worth noting that both the candidates who were targeted did lose by pretty clear margins. And whether or not that was a result of this advertising campaign, I was inundated. I think I had three of those large, glossy political mailers that arrived in my mailbox, and a lot of money spent on TV ads.
Yeah, I certainly got some in my mailbox too. A lot of them did, you know, criticize Goodson for her, you know, personal gifts she'd received from trial lawyers in Arkansas. And, it's kind of amazing. And the other fact, you know, the other thing about that is we don't know exactly how much was spent on those mailers. The only numbers that we're able to see about advertising from these dark money groups is through TV ads, because they have to television stations in the state and markets around Arkansas have to report to the FCC. And that's the only way we've kind of find out about how much money has been spent there.
Well, there were concerns raised by Governor Asa Hutchinson about the influence of the so-called dark money on these judicial races. And suggested on the day after Election Day, when he was speaking to the Political Animals Club in Little Rock, that he would back a bill that it had been pitched last year by Representative Matthew Shepard of El Dorado that would change Arkansas to having governors appoint judges, and that would then face approval. But here's what he said after that meeting.
I do expect that to be on the agenda in the general session next year. Matthew Shepard sponsored it previously. I've talked to him. I fully expect him to bring that legislation back.
And the governor also said that really this is the only way to limit the influence of outside money. And of course, you know, a governor would like to have that position. But the unprecedented nature of this, with a record amount spent here in these state Supreme Court races, he said really is giving too much power to outside groups.
Yeah, and should also note that bill by Shepard, it would have to be a constitutional amendment. You know, the legislature can approve up to three, I think, constitutional amendments to be placed on the ballot in the coming general election. So if it's floated in the 2017 legislature, that would mean the 2018 general election would be when, you know, voters would have to decide on that constitutional amendment. So it might be a couple of years before we actually see real changes too.
Well, one thing at on Election Day did prove to be good for Governor Hutchinson is the candidates who faced challenges in primaries who were targeted because they had supported the private option in the past. Only one of the candidates, I believe there were eight candidates who were targeted, who the governor had even brought out at a press conference, said they shouldn't be criticized or be voted out of office because of their support for the private option, which he wants to become known as Arkansas Works. And this election comes just a few weeks before a special session is held by the Arkansas legislature to consider proposed changes by the governor. And the makeup of the legislature would not have changed had these candidates lost in the primary, but it would have still sent a clear indication and perhaps intimidated the other members of the legislature that if these candidates were voted out of office, and they might be worried, well, if I support the continuation of the Medicaid expansion, I too might be targeted. So the governor said essentially that he felt his proposal and the continuation of the Medicaid expansion was essentially on the ballot, and he felt good that all but one of these candidates survived their primary challenge. Here's what he said after speaking to the Political Animals Club, suggesting there is momentum going into next month's special session to pass his version of the insurance program.
It would have been a chilling effect on Arkansas Works had we lost those key races, because then legislators would say, hey, I can't vote for Arkansas Works. I might be targeted next time, and I'll be defenseless.
So anyway, we'll see how that comes out working. One other race we ought to hit on before we move on beyond election-related matters is the race for U.S. Senate. John Bozeman, the Republican senior senator for Arkansas, coasted to an easy victory over Republican challenger Curtis Coleman, got over 70% of the vote. And Bozeman didn't spend any time commenting on his challenger on Tuesday night, instead pivoting to November.
Consequences are huge. We're going to be in a situation where the next president gets to pick at least one Supreme Court judge, the Supreme Court vacancy of Scalia, because we simply aren't going to let this president go forward with the nomination. Yeah.
And Bozeman will face Democrat Connor Eldridge, who did not have a primary opponent in this election. And he's really viewed by Democratic Party leaders as a strong candidate going into this office, and said he's immediately gearing up for this fight, said he wants he and Bozeman to take part in a series of debates and town forums around the state, and is really looking forward to campaigning against Bozeman.
We're going to campaign for the next 24 hours, go to a number of places throughout our state to listen to people in this state, to hear Arkansas's voices, because that's really what's important. People in Arkansas are not being heard by Washington.
And Eldridge is the former U.S. attorney who was appointed by President Obama.
Yeah, and I think, well, the challenge that both of those candidates face is that I know there was a Talk Business Hendricks College poll just last year showing that Bozeman had very little name recognition among, you know, likely Arkansas voters. And I think Eldridge may face the same problem as well. But if Of course, with campaign season coming up, they'll certainly be trying to remedy that.
Yeah, and with neither of the candidates facing a strong primary challenge, we didn't really have advertising dollars spent on either of those. So this is likely something that will become much more heated later in the year. There's also been talk about how Donald Trump, if he is the eventual presidential nominee, could hurt lower ballot races like this race for the U.S. Senate, because you have so many people who might come out strictly to oppose Trump at the polls, and that could be a motivating factor that could help Democrats.
Yeah, but at the same time, if the primary turnout numbers are any indication, I think we'll probably see more Republican voters in November than Democrats, just based on what we saw on Tuesday. So,
well, with the election matters out of the way, moving on to a much lighter topic here, we had singer-songwriter Roseanne Cash in Arkansas. On Thursday, she took part in a fundraiser at the Arkansas Governor's Mansion to benefit the ongoing restoration of her father, Johnny Cash's boyhood home in East Arkansas. I had spoken with Governor Hutchinson last week about the Cash family home.
Love that kind of music, but also I love the connection to Arkansas and her willing to really devote her name and talents to raising money for the museum, Johnny Cash Museum.
And then on Thursday, in advance of her fundraiser at the Governor's Mansion, I spoke with Roseanne Cash for a little while about what this project has meant for her, her family, and also what was in store that evening.
Well, I'm going to talk to them a little bit about the history of the restoration effort, which started when Arkansas State University bought my dad's boyhood home in Dyess, Arkansas, in what they call the sunken lands of Arkansas, several years ago. And we started fundraising, and the family got involved in the restoration project. It's been really something. The house is now completely restored, as is the administration building. And we're continuing to restore the outbuildings on the farm. You know, and it's in a New Deal era Works Progress Administration colony. And there were 500 houses, and about 30 are left. And my dad's boyhood home is one of those houses.
Yeah, and he moved into the house with his family in 1935 when he was three.
3 years old, yeah.
And he had the great line in your song, the remembering five cans of paint sitting in there, and the whole family sat there and wept.
Yes, that's right. He said that his first memory was of going into this new home that really saved their lives, that the government had provided, and that there were five empty cans of paint sitting in the front room. And I put that right into a song I wrote called The Sunken Lands. The first line is five cans of paint.
Well, I've been reporting on this project as it's progressed from the beginning, and I saw it in 2011 when the home was really in rough shape.
Yeah, it was almost to the ground. It was falling apart. They got it just in time, seriously.
Well, what do you think, looking at the home? The home has, since the restoration of the house itself, has been completed, the ground level. They've got the pillars back underneath it, and it's looking good. But what do you think, you know, when you've seen it?
Well, not only is the exterior and the frame restored, but they have meticulously furnished the house in period furnishings. Some of the things my grandparents actually had, you know, that my aunt and uncle, the last two survivors of who lived in that house, have given to the project. And my sisters and I have also donated many things to the museum that's now in the administration building, including my dad's Air Force trunk and his prom booklet, where he had all his friends sign the prom booklet, report cards, letters. So the house itself is like time travel. When you walk in, you feel you could be in 1940. And there's even a newspaper open to a date, you know, in the 40s. The grand opening was last August of 2015.
14?
14. Well, I was here. You're right. Oh, my gosh. Time goes fast, isn't
it? It's been a year and a half.
Oh, my gosh.
I know, because it does feel like yesterday
it
that
does,
I was at that.
That we were talking about this. Anyway, it was an extremely emotional experience. Three of my kids were with me, two of my sisters, and it was to walk in to see exactly as your one of your parents was, where they were as a child, the things they had, the bed they slept in. That's profoundly moving. And this site, it's not just about my dad, though. It's about that era in this country's history, the Works Progress Administration, the farmers, Southern Tenant farmers, and a music heritage site.
You mentioned at that event that you normally turn down requests to take part in Johnny Cash projects.
I do.
But what was it that was different about this one?
I get a lot of projects and ideas sent to me and requests to, you know, write for this book or film or play or record, tribute, you know, endlessly. And I turned down 99% of them because they're other people's ideas of my father and what they want to do, and I'm not in that business. But when Arkansas State University came to us, to the family, and said, we want to do this, immediately I said yes. We all said yes because we knew it would be important to my dad. He always talked about where he grew up and was so proud of it. And he even had written a letter to my mother from the Air Force saying, every rock, every stone, every inch of dirt is important to me from that place, from Dyess. And it was part of who he was. So many of the songs he wrote came from there, Pickin' Time, 5 Feet High and Rising. And we just felt that it would honor him in a way that meant something to him.
Yeah, and you could tell, too, that documentary from 1968 when he drives in the RV and is pointing out every single spot in town.
That's right. You're talking about the man, his world, his music.
That's it, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, amazing. Well, since the house opened up, Dr. Ruth Hawkins with ASU's Arkansas Heritage Site, who has been overseeing the project, says they've had about 10,000 visitors representing 35 countries, and that's even though it hasn't really been marketed heavily yet, as they're still working to complete the overall project. But your dad was obviously an incredible treasure. His music has stood the test of time, but are you surprised at just how big an influence he still is and how people are still such incredible, huge fans?
I'm not surprised because great art and music lasts forever, you know. We still listen to Mozart. And I mean, not to compare my dad to Mozart, but maybe I could if I want, you know.
Probably is to country music.
To country music, right. And so great work lasts forever, and people are still interesting. And he was such an iconic figure, you know. Everybody identified with him, right, left, center, saint. Everybody identified and still does. But the amount of people who have gone to the site already, and as you said, it hasn't really been formally marketed as such, it's very heartening. And then they go on and they go down into the Delta and they see where B.B. King came from, and they see where Howlin' Wolf sat on a joint porch, and they may go on to see William Faulkner's house in Oxford, Mississippi. You know, the Delta and this part of the world is so rich in music and literature and history. I think people around the world are fascinated by it. And this, you know, this is an economic opportunity for Arkansas as well, just bringing visitors and interest like it's creating now.
Yeah, well, a program host at KUAR, Flap Jones, who does not necessarily Nashville, she has a 13-year-old grandson who wants to go see the house. So it's still even connecting
to
with
young
people. And I thought initially that was because of the movie, but it's been 11 years since Walk the Line came out, and yet young people are still, you know, finding a connection with your dad's music.
I can't tell you how many people tell me that. Their children, their grandchildren, you know, youngsters, three-year-olds, dance around the kitchen to Johnny Cash. I mean, it's very heartwarming.
Yeah. Well, your involvement in this project and the reconnection with the South helped inspire your most recent album, The River and the Thread, which came out a little over a year ago. The last time we spoke was just before its release, and it was met with huge critical acclaim. You won 3 Grammy Awards for it. And I hear that as you've been touring around the world, you've been talking about this project with audiences.
I have. Well, one of the songs on The River and the Thread was written about Dias, about my grandmother and how hard her life was. You know, as a tenant farmer in the 30s and 40s in the sunken lands of Arkansas, and raising 7 children and picking cotton. So I wrote The Sunken Lands with her in mind, and after visiting the house, after the restoration project started, right after that, it was inspired by the house. So The River and the Thread really is about a big landscape of Southern history and Southern geography and Southern music. But The Sunken Lands and Etta's Tune, which is set around Memphis, those are particular to this area. You know, it resonates for me very deeply. I think geography gets in your bloodstream.
Yeah. What do you hope in the long run that this house, you know, decades from now, once the master plan is completed, but decades from now, what do you hope that this accomplishes and conveys about your dad?
Well, I think it's set now, you know, that it will last. And that is a huge relief and hugely gratifying to me that it's taken care of now. It's going to last. And if people visit that house and that farm and that little New Deal era community and see how hard they worked. I mean, that's number one. As a modern woman who lives in New York City, I can't imagine working the ground like that and raising 7 children and then after picking cotton, going and cooking and the laundry. I mean, it's just a level of physical labor that we can't really imagine.
Yeah, no electricity the
no
first
electricity
few years.
For the first few years, that's right. An outhouse, giving birth at home. So just the work ethic, that's huge. And that he came from that and created poetry from it. I mean, that's very profound to me. He wrote those songs directly from that earth in that spot. And look what he became.
It's great having you on here.
Michael, thanks for inviting me to speak again.
That's Roseanne Cash speaking with me Thursday in Little Rock. Well, with that, that's KUAR's Weekend Review Podcast. I'm Michael Hiplin.
I'm Chris Hickey.
Our theme song is by our own Chris Hickey. You can find us online at KUAR.org or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, KUAR. Is an editorially independent service of the University of Arkansas at Little Rock. Thanks for listening.